Good afternoon. I'm Sean Canaan with the WMNF Midpoint Monday. Today we continue WMNF's community's conversation about reaction across the country and in the Tampa Bay area to the police killing of George Floyd. Later on in the show, our guest will be Sean Shaw. He is the former Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General and a former state representative. We'll hear a short excerpt from a town hall meeting called LGBTQ Voices to Combat Racial Violence. Our first guest will be a University of Tampa professor who grew up in Minneapolis and wrote an op-ed in the Tampa Bay Times about policing there and here. And we'll take your calls about whether you defied the weather over the weekend to participate in a demonstration, why or why not. Here's the number to call in, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And I should say that this morning I played audio from a video of police shooting at protesters. The video was posted this morning, but it turns out it was from several days ago. There do not appear to have been any instances of Tampa Bay area police attacking protesters this weekend. And I want to thank you for listening to WMNF during these times of important news stories. Even though we're socially distant, we still feel a strong connection with our listeners and supporters. Instead of a one-week fundraising drive this summer, we're trying something we think you'll like. It's a series of one-day membership drives. The first one is a week from today. I hope you support Midpoint Monday and all of the essential WMNF news and music shows next Monday, or better yet, make a donation right now in our tip jar at wmnf.org. We begin the show with a short excerpt from a very interesting town hall from last week. It was hosted by the group Equality Florida. The title was LGBTQ Voices to Combat Racial Violence. It was moderated by Equality Florida Executive Director Nadine Smith. We'll hear just a bit from her right now, and then we'll be joined by our first guest. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday, and here is Nadine Smith talking about LGBTQ Voices to Combat Racial Violence.
When we began to envision this panel weeks ago, George Floyd was alive in Minneapolis. Tony McDade had not been shot by police in Tallahassee. We began the planning in the aftermath of Ahmaud Arbery's killing by white vigilantes just 2 hours over the Florida border. We'd organized an LGBTQ response in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin's murder, and the echoes were unmistakable. We also wanted to draw attention and outrage to the epidemic of black transgender women being murdered, including 7 transgender women murdered in Florida in less than 2 years. And we wanted to ensure that when people say Black Lives Matter, and they should, that they truly meant all Black Lives Matter. And finally, with Pride Month approaching, we really wanted to reassert June as a commemoration of a street rebellion against hate violence and unchecked police brutality. We wanted to be one of the voices that said enough is enough, that the normalization of police brutality, so normal that the presence of video cameras did not save George Floyd, had to be challenged, and LGBT voices had to be part of challenging it. And finally, we wanted to amplify the voices of the Black LGBTQ experience, we who live in the intersection of identities, with the added danger that racism and anti-LGBTQ hatred puts in our path. And now this conversation comes as people have taken to the streets, where the brutality that is a common occurrence in Black neighborhoods is now on display for the entire nation and the entire world. America is at a crossroads. In the words of demographer James Johnson, we are a country in a demographic convulsion, a nation increasingly of Black and brown people, young Black and brown people, and older white people. And the shifting demographics have created a panic that expresses itself not only in the words and obvious actions of white supremacists, but also in the fear and discomfort and silence of white people who see that shift and wonder what it might be like to be no longer be numerically the majority, but instead part of a pluralistic society, what it might mean to be a minority in a country that has not treated minorities well. So it was with that spirit that we began this conversation, that we invited these panelists, and in this context, we think it is critical that the LGBTQ community be vocal and visible, unafraid to say the words white supremacy, unafraid to speak out to end the violence, state-sanctioned and hate-sanctioned, against the Black community, and to remember that this is our fight. We do not show up to it as allies, but we understand that our liberation, that our freedom is tied to ending this system. Obviously, this is a week that has roiled the nation. You know, in this moment where people are trying to figure out how best to show up, how best to make this not just a flash in the pan, but a real catalyst for lasting change. You know, I know that my inbox is filled with people asking, what did we do? You know, what's the most strategic way to engage? White people who want to be allies, you know, asking, well, you know, how do we show up? And I guess part of that question is, for me, it is, what is your motivating self-interest? Because at the end of the day, I think that if people aren't motivated by something that is very personal to their, you know, I'll say it this way. We will have a multiracial, equitable democracy, or we will have chaos. The only thing that is different right now is that the circumstances that have been a constant presence in Black neighborhoods are now visible to people who are shocked to see the militarization of police, the absolute disdain, the normalization of brutality. But these are not new things. The same mentality that allows us to cage children at the border is the same lack of concern for human life that allows a president to order the forcible removal of people in front of a church for a photo op. And the photo op isn't just him in front of a church awkwardly holding the Bible. It is the show of force itself. So in this moment where we have an administration that is very willing, eager in fact, to use force, intimidate, attempt to strike fear, coupled with a community that is pouring into the streets even as we speak, where do we go from here? What happens next? How do people show up?
That's Equality Florida Executive Director Nadine Smith. She was speaking last week during an online town hall meeting. It was called LGBTQ Voices to Combat Racial Violence. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. It's 12:14 in the afternoon, and my name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. You can call in at 813-239-9663 or email your comments or questions to dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We're now joined by our first guest. Liv Coleman is an associate professor of political science and international studies at the University of Tampa. She grew up in Minneapolis, and in an opinion piece this weekend in the Tampa Bay Times, she wrote about her experiences with police there and in Tampa. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Professor Coleman.
Thanks so much for having me on here, Sean.
Really appreciate you joining us today. Well, we're hearing a lot about the Minneapolis Police Department since the killing of George Floyd. You grew up in the city. What can you tell us about, is there an institutional racism in the city and or in the police department that maybe those of us in the South might be surprised to hear about from a northern city?
Well, you know, Minneapolis itself as a city, like any city in America, does have a history and legacy of institutional racism. I mean, it dates back to housing covenants that were restrictive based on categories of race, or highways driven through Black neighborhoods that displaced Black families. And there is practices that are, you know, well documented that show that the police have disproportionately policed or imprisoned Black and Indigenous people of color in the city, and this is an ongoing issue. And you know, on the one hand, it's not exactly fair to put it all on the police because, again, these are systemic issues that have been going on for a long, long time in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the whole country.
Not to focus then on the police, but there is this anecdote that's kind of going around since we've been learning more about the Minneapolis police, and that is that a lot of the officers that are employed by the police kind of live outside the city. They aren't from the city. They're from maybe the suburbs or someplace that has a different feel than the inner city of Minneapolis. What do you know about that dynamic?
There was an article in the Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper a few years ago that documented how the police were, you know, over 90% of the police live outside the city of Minneapolis. It's something like 92% of live in the suburbs or even exurbs. So they live far away from the communities that they're actually policing and interacting with. And it's really hard to talk or think about what community policing really means when people don't live in the community.
And they might not have a kind of an understanding of what is going on in that community to know how best to serve it.
Or right, it could be, an attitude of seeing them as outsiders or different, or you know, in the worst case scenario, as an enemy.
So you turned 20 years ago or so, if I have the timing right, you interned in the office of the first black and the first woman mayor of Minneapolis, Sharon Sales Belton. What did you do there, and what did you learn?
I was there in summers of, I think, 1999 and 2000, and I had a great experience there. I deeply admire Mayor Sharon Sales Belton. And I did a lot of work that interns do in political offices, which is to say, I answer the phones, and I answered emails or wrote letters back to constituents who called in with different kinds of issues. And, I sometimes attended city meetings or wrote little reports about what I heard or learned and spread them to other policy officials. But, you know, the big chunk of the job was constituent interaction, and responding to police issues was, in some cases, part of that.
And one constituent that and a police issue that you did respond to was the case of Barbara Schneider. Tell us about her, what happened with her.
That was, yeah, it was a disturbing case. It was in, June of 2000. And so I was an intern, and she was a woman who was, a middle-aged woman, and she was at home, and a neighbor called with a noise complaint. The music was too loud, and they sent out police officers to respond to the noise complaint. And it turns out the woman was bipolar or having some kind of episode, and she started ranting that the police were like Satan's helpers or something like that. And she was very disturbed by the police presence, got very nervous, and then she had a knife, and then the police responded with force, and they killed her. And it was a case where it was disturbing from my perspective. Well, for a number of reasons, but it was the kind of thing where if they'd been trained to recognize that she was mentally ill, they might have had a different approach. They might have tried to de-escalate the situation or listen, or they might have sent other people in instead. But that's not what happened, unfortunately. And at the time, I was an intern. My mother was a longtime mental health activist, and so there I was trying to respond to constituents at the Minneapolis mayor's office, and, what can you say to them? The handling of the Minneapolis Police Department, like most police departments, is you say, there's going to be an investigation, and they do have an investigation, and they go think through the process, and they do take the issues seriously, but, it just seems like over and over again that there's just not a lot of reforms that happen. Eventually, they did put in place, in response to this case and others, a new model of policing to respond to mental health crises. But in this case, we still see it happen far too often across the country.
And maybe we'll talk in a bit about what are some reforms that could happen that could help these cases where there's cases where the police aren't trained well enough to handle certain situations. But I want to remind people that you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. My name is Sean Canaan. Our guest is Liv Coleman. She's an associate professor of political science and international studies at the University of Tampa. And that wasn't the only situation that you were close to where police used violence against someone with a mental health issue. When you were at the university, you are at the University of Tampa, but one of your students was also hurt by police.
Yeah, I had a student. He was a non-traditional age student, and he was a military veteran, and he was feeling suicidal, and he was in his car all by himself, and his wife called the police to ask them to help him and work out the situation, and police showed up, and they shot him, and I'm happy to say he survived, but it was, it's just incredibly traumatic and horrifying, and just to think, my heart just totally went out for him and his family. I mean, he has a wife and kids and the whole bit, and it's a traumatic experience, and it felt like the same kind of situation all over again that I dealt with years ago in Minneapolis, and it was kind of like, what's going on with police and their training? And it turns out there hadn't been the full kind of training happening in the police department that one might expect.
Was there an investigation after that case, and what was there any reform that happened?
There's always investigations to these incidents, and I believe that they have instituted more robust training. I don't know what the standard is at the moment, but I believe they did respond and institute new and more frequent trainings, but I don't know exactly the process that they're going through right now.
Our guest is Liv Coleman, an associate professor of political science and international studies at the University of Tampa. It's 12:22 in the afternoon, and you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. We're talking about the recent demonstrations and the police response and maybe how similar things are in Tampa and Minneapolis and some differences that have happened. I do want to read this email that just came from the St. Pete Police just a few minutes ago, and maybe get your comments on it. After a thorough review of our policies, Chief Holloway has decided to add the following language to the department's general orders. Officers have a duty to intervene to prevent or stop wrongdoing by another officer when it is safe and reasonable to do so. So this new policy that they've just added within the last hour or so apparently stems from what we saw on the videotape in Minneapolis, where there were three officers who didn't intervene as one officer or more than one was kneeling on George Floyd. Your response, how do you think of that as a policy tweak, I guess, that the St. Pete Police are implementing?
That's very encouraging to hear. I'm really glad to hear that. After the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, too, they instituted similar kind of reform. They're working with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and they're saying that you can't just be a bystander, that if you see force being used inappropriately, you have a duty to intervene. So that's very encouraging. That sounds like exactly the right kind of step to start shifting a culture, however slowly.
Another thing that we're learning about from Minneapolis in the last 24 hours is that the city council, a majority, says that they will support disbanding the city's police department. What do you think that will look like?
I'm not entirely sure what it will look like, and I don't know if anyone knows exactly what it will look like, but there have been activists in Minneapolis who, for a number of years already, who've been talking about this issue of police reform toward a police-free future. There's a group of a community coalition called MPD 150, and you can actually find their whole report at mpd150.com. And they looked at the history of policing in Minnesota, and they talk about how people have tried to reform the police over and over again, and Minneapolis has a lot of very progressive police training and processes in place, but we see that problems keep happening in the community, and excessive force keeps being used, and we still have disproportionate policing of Black and Indigenous people of color. And so there are community groups like Black Visions Collective and Reclaim the Block, and they're kind of, they've been working together with researchers and artists and activists to come together with comprehensive solutions. And a good part of that is this notion that we spend a lot of money on policing. I mean, cities like New York City spend something like $6 billion annually. L.A. spends $2 billion annually. And the idea is that maybe you could take some of that money and then you could redirect it to other programs that could reach people in the community, based on the notion that there's other sources of crime and there's other needs in the community, that if you work with, you know, social workers to get to help to people, or nurses or other professionals, you might be able to spend it in those categories instead of on policing, where sometimes the use of force is inappropriate. So I'm not sure what it's going to look like. They do have a veto-proof majority on the city council right now to take some really significant actions, and they say dismantle the police. It's hard for me. The mayor's taken a more cautious approach at the moment. He says he doesn't want to see the Minneapolis Police Department abolished or disbanded, but he also wants to see really thoroughgoing reforms of some kind. So maybe they'll meet in the middle somewhere. I don't know. But these conversations have been happening for a long time, and there's a lot of careful work behind the scenes by activists to come up with new solutions.
What does it mean when the Minneapolis community or communities here in the Tampa Bay area say that they want community control of police?
When people say community control of the police, I think, you know, that I think a lot of that is having civilian review boards and just having community input into the police to make sure there is community oversight. In some cases, it might mean mandates for police to live in the city on a residential basis. But I think a lot of that is just making sure there's citizen input and oversight, especially in cases where things go wrong.
When Tampa was implementing its community review board of the police 4 or 5 years ago, there was a lot of pushback from activists that said that it didn't really have teeth. They couldn't subpoena people. They couldn't, you know, get the police to testify under oath. I think it was one of their sticking points. Do you know how that has worked out in Tampa, how the community review board of the police department has, how that's been working out?
To be honest, I haven't followed up. I actually live in Bradenton, just south of Tampa, so I haven't followed those issues quite as closely to see how they're going. But that is, I just remember from my Minneapolis days, Minneapolis has had citizen review boards for years, too, even the time the Barbara Schneider case happened. I think there were citizen review boards in place, and that was part of the answer I gave to people, too, when I was on the phones answering constituent calls. Yeah, there's a citizen review board. But as you mentioned, oftentimes, you review cases, but then officers don't get just minor disciplinary, on their record, infractions on their record. They go back to policing, and we do see that a lot of police who've been disciplined in Minneapolis, in Florida, all over the country, sometimes they're disciplined, dozens of times for excessive use of force, and they still go back to policing. Or even if they're let go, they still end up being hired by some other police department. So it does seem like there needs to be something beyond the civilian review board model as it stands, but the idea that there are citizens participating in this dialogue itself seems to be a valuable one.
Our guest is Liv Coleman, an associate professor of political science and international studies at the University of Tampa. She wrote an op-ed in yesterday's Tampa Bay Times about her experience with the Minneapolis police and with Tampa police. And this is WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and you can call in at 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Today we're going to see the first court appearance of the man who has been charged with second-degree murder in the death of George Floyd. That's Officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. He's also charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. And what do you anticipate will happen in this case? Do you think that it will be moved out of Minneapolis? And if that happens, do you think that it's more or less likely that there will be a fair trial?
It's hard to imagine anyone not hearing about this, not knowing about this. I mean, there have been protests in all kinds of small towns across Minnesota and all across the country. I don't know. I hope he does receive a fair trial, of course. I'm not sure what will happen. And I've heard even some, questions about whether it would be, because police do have qualified immunity, it's hard in many circumstances, even when you have really, video or things like that. It's hard to secure convictions sometimes. So I'm not really sure how it's going to go, but I guess we'll see.
And what's your take on the scale of the protests that we've seen over the last 2 weeks? They started out, of course, in Minneapolis, and they swiftly spread around the U.S. and around the world. As you were saying, almost every community, there's been some sort of protest. What was it about this where it just seems to have lit a fire under activists to make some changes?
I think the case itself, on video, it was so awful to watch and so transgressive and so, it just seemed to be a really blatant case of, race as the defining factor. It's hard to say, but it seems that way. And I think it really resonated with people all across the country that there are systemic racial injustices and discrimination. And I think, so it's not just a Minneapolis issue. It's an issue, and it's not just a policing issue. You hear a lot of really painful stories that people are telling right now, and a lot of hopeful stories, too, about, we've got this incredible movement for change. We've got thousands of people in D.C. and Tampa, St. Pete, Brandon, Lakeville, Bradenton, Sarasota, everywhere, in this state and across the country. And it's hard to say. I haven't seen anything like this in years. I don't know how it compares to the Women's March shortly after President Trump's inauguration, but it's certainly comparable in its scope and sweep. And to see a lot of young people get involved and people of color is really, encouraging that they're having their voices heard, and we've got young activists who are leading the way, and it's very inspiring.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Professor Coleman.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you. Liv Coleman is an associate professor of political science and international studies at the University of Tampa, and I want to thank her for coming on the show today. You are listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. This is Midpoint Monday on WMNF. I'm Sean Canaan, and we turn now to our next guest. Joining us by phone, Sean Shaw was the Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General in 2018. He's a former state representative as well. I want to welcome you back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Sean.
Hey, how's it going, Sean? How are you doing?
It's going great. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's just start with your initial thoughts of the events of the last 2 weeks. George Floyd was killed 2 weeks ago, and we've seen protests against police violence and racism go global since then. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's obviously wonderful to see the protests. It's not wonderful that we still have to protest for this reason here in 2020, but it's wonderful to see the protests themselves. It's wonderful to see who's a part of the protests, and that they're actually, you know, getting stuff done policy-wise because of the protests. I'm really glad to see that. I'm one that's kind of, I'm in the boat where I'm kind of tired of the community town halls and discussions and vigils and these things, and I want policy change that will prevent George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Eric Garner and Trayvon Martin and all these countless names from happening again. So I'm glad to see action actually taking place, and it's makes you hopeful.
And I asked our last guest, Liv Coleman, about this, but what do you think it was that was, makes this one so, it just took off like crazy, the protests quickly and got very large?
I think it's the video, and I think it's how long the knee was on the neck, 8 minutes and 46 seconds, and I think the other officers standing and watching. So I think it's a combination of all of those things that really people had enough. You'd seen some other videos, but it didn't seem to be as stark as this and as long as this. And you know this, the civil rights movement in the 60s was kind of catapulted by those images that the rest of America started seeing of how African-American protesters were being treated, whether it's by dogs and hoses and those sorts of things. Those images started going across the TVs and newspapers and magazine covers around the country, and I think America started kind of changing because of those images, and it certainly feels like that may be where we're at today.
Yesterday, the local chapter of Omega Psi Phi fraternity gathered in Curtis Hickson Waterfront Park for a protest. It was called The Time Is Now, and it included several minutes of silence, the amount of time, as you mentioned earlier. Why the silence, and why did you call it The Time Is Now?
Well, as you know, I'm a member of Omega Psi Phi, and it's a historically black fraternity founded by four college-educated African-American men, and we just thought it was we needed to do something. Certainly, as African-American men, George Floyd could have been any of us there. And so we had The Time Is Now, and time we thought was important because of the 8 minutes and 46 seconds, which is the time that the officer's knee was on George Floyd's neck. So we wanted to march symbolically, and we wanted to stand there for that amount of time. And Sean, I'll tell you, when you're standing there for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, it's a long time. And it, as I was standing there, all I could kind of think, and I couldn't get out of my mind, was, you know, what was going through George Floyd's mind. And we have some of his words that were going through certainly his mouth. He was, you know, get your knee off my neck, I can't breathe. I didn't really do anything. He was calling for his mother who had already passed. It was, those were the kind of thoughts that were going on in my head, and it was really powerful. But we wanted to do something. We wanted to focus on the amount of time, and I thought it was a powerful statement to see that group of black men in suits standing there in solidarity with George Floyd for that amount of time, and certainly standing there to demand that we institute some policies to prevent this from happening again and again and again and again.
Our guest is Sean Shaw. He was the Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General in 2018. He's a former state representative as well. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canam. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You're welcome to send us an email, dj@WMNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. And one of the questions that I'm asking this hour is if you were at the demonstrations over the weekend, what made you go? What were your impressions? What did you think about it? So, Sean, let me tell you, there's this graphic called hashtag 8Can't Wait, and it's about President Obama's use of force pledge. And the St. Petersburg police said on Facebook over the weekend that they're committed to the 8Can't Wait. And we heard last hour, actually, a recording from Brian Dugan, the Tampa police chief, that they have already implemented it, or I think that was maybe even Tampa Mayor Jane Castor said that it was implemented when she was chief. And I'll read out what the eight different tenants of the 8Can't Wait are. And we also heard this hour that the St. Petersburg police said that they have committed to having officers intervene to prevent or stop any wrongdoing by another officer when it's safe and reasonable to do so. So, I'm going to get your response in just a second, but let me quickly read these eight tenets of the 8Can't Wait. Eight policies are: ban chokeholds and strangleholds, require de-escalation, require warning before shooting, require that you exhaust all alternatives before shooting, there's the duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, require use of force continuum, and require comprehensive reporting. So based on your experience or reading about cases, do you think that the local law enforcement agencies are going to be committed to taking all these seriously?
You know, I was told the same thing, that Tampa Police Department had already implemented the 8 for 8. And I'll just say it needs more teeth. I saw the responses on the City of Tampa website in response to the 8 for 8. They've listed kind of what they've done and how they claim they've already kind of implemented these 8 for 8. The most important ones, in my opinion, are: what do you do with officers who have multiple complaints of excessive force? How does the public know who those officers are? How do they get disciplined? What's the process? I think that is really important. And are you hiring officers who have these multiple complaints? Almost every officer who is involved in these incidents that we're talking about has multiple complaints of excessive force against them, and yet they're still on the street. And I think this officer had maybe 8 to 10 complaints, the one that we're talking about with regard to George Floyd. So I think that's super important. And I think what's also important, and I don't know if this is part of 8 for 8, 8 Can't Wait, but this needs to happen, which is a national database of these, not only the incidents themselves, the George Floyds, the Eric Garners, those sorts of things, but also these officers, so that, for example, an officer who has 25 excessive force complaints in Oklahoma can't move to Florida and get a job on a Florida police force because Florida doesn't know how many excessive force complaints he may have. Any sort of gap there in the reporting and how the states talk to each other needs to be filled in with a national database, as well as how we keep track of these incidents themselves. That's my thought.
I'm going to ask you a political question, or a question that could have political undertones. And I get that you might be uncomfortable answering it, but try to do what you can. The mayor of Tampa is a former police chief. Do you think that has any bearing on how the police are treated in the city?
Certainly, it has some bearing, right? We're all creatures of our experiences and where we come from. But I will tell you, I think it has some bearing. I would say that I think the mayor is trying to be trying to handle this in the best way she can. But we're at a place where the presumption in favor of the police that society has given, we really need to start looking at that presumption and whether it should be continually given, given all these incidents we have. And it's just, I don't think anyone can imagine, and I know we've got a lot of people participating in the protests, but it's hard to imagine, if you're not a black man, the interaction with police and what it does to you and how you act and the knot in the pit of your stomach and the talks you've had with your elders about how to deal with it. That talk that all black men, no matter where you went to school, no matter who your parents are, no matter what side of town you grew up in, no matter how old or young, no matter how many degrees you have, every black man has had that talk with an elder on how to deal with police, because that talk is necessary, because there have always been these incidents of black men being mistreated by police, that talk itself is the reason we've got these 2 weeks of protests. And it's that talk and the reason we have to have that talk and the fear that requires that mandates that talk is really what we've got to get at. That's the kind of kernel of what we need to be focused on. And, you know, the mayor and her staff have said that they are in they're in compliance, but they can't wait. So I've got to take them at their word on that. But I don't like the way the police have responded to the protesters here in Tampa. I mean, I'll say that. I don't like how they've responded to the protests in terms of the force used. The chief of police has said that they haven't used tear gas and they haven't used bullets. Some of the protesters and eyewitnesses at these events refute that. So these were protests that these are some of the ones that I was not at. So I don't know. But what I will say is the two sides aren't agreeing on the use of force. But what hopefully the two sides can agree on is that any policy or procedure that can be implemented to prevent George Floyd type incidents from happening again need to be implemented. And that, I think, there's even more than just the eight can't wait. I think there's more things that can be done. But, you know, we've got to get our collective mind around this, not only as it relates to police brutality, but this is just one offshoot of America's kind of, you know, raw wound of race that I was saying the other day. It scabs over sometimes, but the scab is removed, and then we have some other incidents. The wound itself is never healed, and we need to get at the healing of that wound, which is race in the country.
Our guest is Sean Shaw, the 2018 Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General and a former state representative, and you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint on 88.5 FM. It's 12:43 in the afternoon. We're going to take your calls. The number is 813-239-9663. You can also text your comments or questions to 813-433-0885 or email dj@wmnf.org. And Sean, you mentioned that you didn't like the way that police responded to demonstrations by shooting projectiles at demonstrators and attacking demonstrators. And we've talked to many people who have been injured by Tampa police and maybe some of the other police departments around here. What should happen to police officers who shoot and injure peaceful demonstrators?
Well, certainly an investigation, a transparent investigation, and discipline. But it's all got to be transparent, and the public has to see it. I think that's one of the things the public is frustrated about, because, you know, certainly when you're dealing with police discipline, sometimes it's not as open to the public and as transparent as it needs to be. And that's why you can sometimes have officers who have multiple incidents of excessive force, and the public doesn't know it, and they're out here on the street. And so I think these things need to be transparent, they need to be public, and they need to, if someone has been shown to be mistreating protesters, they need to be disciplined. I don't think that's anything that's, you know, out of the realm of reasonable, but that's what people are mad about. People are mad about this presumption that officers are untouchable, and that they have their own process, and they deal with their own discipline the way they will, and the public just needs to understand that it's hard to be a police officer, and we're doing the best we can. The public's tired of that. The public is tired of that. The public wants transparent and public procedures on how to deal with these disciplinary matters, number one, and they want to certainly understand and know that there are policies in place to prevent these sorts of things, whether it's what you said, the eight can't wait, implicit bias training, you know, how you deal with community policing, those sorts of things. But this is just, it's too many of these incidents. And I also want to, you know, ask your listeners, what if this wasn't on video? How many of these incidents do we know that are taking place that you don't have a record of, that you don't have on a cell phone video, that you don't have, maybe it's your word against police officer, and because you don't have video, your word wasn't believed, and so it wasn't investigated. There must be, you know, exponential multitudes of these incidents taking place that aren't being treated as George Floyd's is, because his entire thing was on video. And there's. I just want you to imagine how upsetting and scared we need to be as a country of how many incidents must be going on that aren't getting this type of attention.
And you're talking about the review of police and their actions. Tampa does have a police civilian review board. What are your thoughts about whether it needs to be have more powers or how it's worked out so far?
I mean, I think it needs to have subpoena powers. That's what we're all kind of getting at. That's what I think everyone is moving towards, that that review board needs a little bit more power, and that needs to start with subpoena power. And so what was okay 5-10 years ago and how we deal with these things is just simply not okay now. And we need to go further, and we need to do more. So that, I think, is a starting place.
Our guest is Sean Shaw. He was the Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General a couple of years ago. He's a former state representative, and you're listening to Midpoint. You can join this conversation by calling 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Sean, I hope you don't mind. We're going to take a phone call right now from Suzanne in Tampa. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. How are you?
Doing great. What's your question or comment?
I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to say that rewatched the movie Selma last night, and on the one hand, I'm, you know, crushed that we're going through this all these years later. But on the other hand, I really do feel that there's hope here, because we do have a broader group of people who have recognized, finally, as a white woman, we have all recognized that we really need to step up more to the plate, and whatever I can do to help and get everyone to vote, and let's really move on and get this behind us. And I will say, even what I've learned the last, and I always feel like I'm pretty aware, but even what I've learned the last couple of weeks about the lack of accountability and tracking of our justice system and police forces is shocking to me, and I feel bad that I never knew about that. So I'm happy to help, and let's move this forward.
Suzanne, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in, and you can join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. And we're talking with Sean Shaw. He's a former state representative from Tampa and was the 2018 Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General. And Suzanne talked a little bit about how attitudes are changing, perhaps, and you've talked about that as well. Here's a poll that I'm looking at from an article in Politico that 6 years ago, after Eric Garner was killed, 33% of Americans and 26% of whites said that police are more likely to use excessive force against African Americans. And now, the same question, 57% of Americans and 49% of whites say that police are more likely to use excessive force against African Americans. So that's 6 years. Sean Shaw, what do you think has changed in those 6 years?
I mean, people, as my dad would say, people started believing their eyes. I mean, you got to believe what's in front of your face, and we're seeing these videos over and over and over again, and in various states and various law enforcement agencies, and we're just seeing it with our eyes. You can't deny what your eyes are showing you, and so I think those numbers are moving, and you know, you can just see that this is not a one-off problem. This is a systemic problem, and your last caller said it best. This is kind of everyone's problem. It may be black men who are directly getting the physical brunt of it, but this is America's problem. This is everybody's problem, and everyone in their own way needs to figure out how they want to do what they can do to deal with it. I was just, you know, I'm involved in, and I said that I had my own radio show at noon on Saturdays, and I said myself, you know, some of the things I'm going to do going forward, or any candidate that seeks my support, or any group that wants me to be a member or wants me to support their mission, I'm going to ask them, I want to see your statement on the death of George Floyd. And if you don't have a statement, then I'm not going to support your organization or your candidacy. And I think that that's not a lot to ask. I think the least you can do is have issued a statement or something on the death of George Floyd. And I just think that we need to be doing some of those things. I'm, you know, politics and is kind of what I'm involved in, and I've seen kind of a disappointing response by some elected officials, or lack of response. And so the only thing I can do is that if that person asks me for their support, for my support, I can say no, because I'm dissatisfied with your response to George Floyd. So that's something that I'm certainly going to try to implement, not try to implement, I am going to implement it, and that's really the least that I think someone running for office, someone in office, or any organization can do.
Our guest is Sean Shaw, the 2018 Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General and a former state representative. And you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:52 in the afternoon, and we're taking your calls at 813-239-9663. We have Tim in Sarasota. Welcome to the show, Tim. Have you been to any demonstrations in Sarasota that you wanted to tell us about?
No, actually, I have just a real simple question.
Mm-hmm.
Don't the police have to maintain records of the things that they use, like tear gas and rubber bullets, and isn't that information accessible so we can see what the truth is? I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, Tim, thanks so much for calling in. Sean, what are the rules when it comes to police and maintaining records of the weapons that they're using?
I don't know, actually. That's a very good question, but you know what the situation we're in now is that the chief of police says we're not using tear gas and rubber bullets, and the demonstrators are saying, yes, you are. And so what do we do now? And I think the caller's got a great question. He confirmed, other than the chief's word, how do we confirm what's being used and what's not? I don't know. Maybe that is also something we need to look into as to, well, how do we confirm that's not being used? You know, and I'll tell you, I've gotten multiple first hand accounts of people at these protests who are saying that what the chief is saying is not true, and I'm not there, so I can't tell you one way or the other. I can just tell you there are certainly first-hand accounts of people refuting what the chief is saying, and so the caller has a good question. It's a question that maybe we need to figure out how we can confirm these things in the future going forward.
A week ago, there was a lot of property destruction after one of the demonstrations in Tampa. Well after, hours after, there were buildings burned and things like that. Do you know if any of that violence could have been caused by some of the white racists who were infiltrating those protests?
I don't know. And this is one of the unfortunate things that flow when you have a president who kind of traffics in the worst of America and it kind of finds its way back down to us. You know, people that don't want to believe that there is systemic racism and that there's police brutality will be in their corner and believe that all the looters are these black thugs who are destroying property and they ought to go get a job, so to speak. And then those of us who believe that there is systemic racism and police brutality will understand what we're protesting for, and we'll you know, ascribe to some of the theories that there are, yeah, white nationalists infiltrating the protest to try to foment kind of a race war. So, but the problem is we're both in our corners, and there's no one to kind of bring us together to our higher purpose, so to speak. Certainly not the President of the United States when he's kind of trafficked, as I said, in the worst of America. We need. That's why you need someone speaking behind that podium at the White House, someone who can bring hope to America no matter what your party is, someone that you can believe what they're actually saying, someone who you believe is exhibiting empathy for kind of what's going on, and the President of the United States exhibits none of that, in my opinion. So we are here left to our own kind of partisan devices, and here we are. And, you know, Sean, I don't know if these incidents and the protests that are going on, I don't know if they're changing anyone's mind. I don't know if there's anyone who was kind of supporting the president or supporting that agenda who now says, you know what, I think now I don't and I'm going somewhere else. I don't know if that's existing or if we're just retreating to our own corners in even a more major way. But it's unfortunate that we are in this place, but we are. But the protests are big, and they are diverse, and they are, for the very, very majority, extreme majority, peaceful, but there is some property damage, and who's causing it is certainly a point of contention. If you look at my Facebook post, it's either white nationalists or it's people on public assistance that need to go get a job. Those are the two kind of you know theories that are being on my Facebook thread, and it's not only is it sad, but it's fascinating to see the chasm between these two Americas we got.
You know, it's interesting that you said that it's possible that nobody's mind is being changed. What about someone like Drew Brees, who was always he's a quarterback for in the NFL for the Saints. He was always opposed to Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, and he even said something in the last couple of weeks to that effect. And then, I guess from the reaction he got from his fellow players, it sounds like he had a sincere turn of heart where now he says, you know, we really need to listen to black people.
It doesn't sound like it was sincere to me. It
okay.
sounds like that was a lot of backlash, and so Drew Brees understood that he stepped into it and he shouldn't have, and he needed to do something to clear it up. His very first statement with regard to Kaepernick were against Kaepernick and started bringing up the flag, which most people understand is not the right response. He then doubled down on that after these protests, and then that's when he got the backlash, and that's when he started to say, I don't understand. And so that's two strikes against him, and then one apology after he got blasted. That doesn't sound sincere to me, unfortunately. And, you know, there's some people who are making statements that I do feel are sincere. For example, George W. Bush's statement I thought was one of the most eloquent statements anyone of any race, of any partisan persuasion has issued on what's going on in America today. And if you'd have told me that I was going to say that 10 years ago, I would have told you, you're right. What are you talking about? But it was the tone was correct. The focus was correct. He was obviously had a lot of empathy and sadness and was kind of, again, looking to what the best of America is rather than what we're doing now, which is trying to traffic in the worst of America. So there's certainly some out there that are issuing the statements, but in terms of actual minds being changed, I don't think so. I think people are just getting yelled at in social media, and so they're issuing apologies. But Drew Brees' first two inclinations were to talk about, I don't like what Kaepernick's doing, it disrespects the flag. Those are his first two inclinations, and then he got yelled at on social media and said, oh, I'm sorry. I'm not moved.
Well, Sean, before we wrap up, I just want to read that there are two demonstrations, at least two, planned for today. From 2 o'clock until 9 o'clock, there's a St. Pete peaceful protest at City Hall in St. Pete. And in Ybor City, the Tampa Bay SDS has rescheduled its Justice for George Floyd demonstration for this afternoon at 5:30 at Centennial Park. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint today, Sean.
No, of course. Thank you for having me, man, and I appreciate all you're doing to keep the community abreast, man. I appreciate it. I've always loved your stuff.
Thank you. I'm really glad you came on the show. Sean Shaw was the 2018 Democratic nominee for Florida Attorney General, and he's a former state representative. I want to thank everyone who called, emailed, and texted today, and I'm really sorry for those of you still on the line that didn't get to call in. If you want to email me, I will respond by email, dj@wmnf.org. And if you missed any of the show, you can listen to it on our website, wmnf.org/news. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or YouTube at WMNF News. And I want to thank you for listening to WMNF during these times of important news stories. Even though we're socially distant, we still feel a strong connection with our listeners and supporters. Instead of a one-week fundraising drive this summer, we're trying something that we think you'll like, a series of one-day membership drives. The first one is a week from today. I hope you support Midpoint Monday and all of the essential WMNF news and music shows next Monday. Or better yet, can you make a donation right now in our tip jar at WMNF.org? I want to thank Rob Lori, Frank Knox, DT, and Miss Julie for all their help on the show today. I'm Sean Canaan. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to our guests, Sean Shaw and Liv Coleman.